Well, have you ever been seasick or had motion sickness? Well, we've got Professor John Golding with us now from the University of Westminster in London to tell us all about it. Great to have you on the show, John.
Hello, nice to hear from you.
Now, I always find this quite amazing with how far we've come over the years, because humans have been crossing seas for at least 65,000 years, and yet we still don't seem to have quite understood what seasickness is.
Well, that's not quite true. I think we know the mechanisms now. Unfortunately, we don't have any fantastic magic bullet cures.
Okay, so what exactly is happening in our bodies then?
Well, as you know, seasickness, which has been, as you say, around many, many thousands of years. In fact, historically, the word nausea, meaning, you know, feel queasy or sick, comes from the Greek word nous, meaning ship or nautical. So it goes back a long way. You can look that up in the dictionary. What seems to be happening, and seasickness is the same as car sickness or air sickness or space sickness or virtual reality sickness, they're all different types of motion sickness. And what appears to be happening is that the information from our eyes and from the balance organs in our inner ears start to conflict with each other. And this sensory conflict or sensory mismatch tells the brain that something is going wrong, and the defense reflex, which is in evolutionary terms very, very old, so animals can get motion sick, is a reflex which makes you feel sick and then can lead to vomiting. So that's well thought out to be the mechanism.
The things that, when things happen in our bodies, I always understand that it's our bodies trying to tell us something. So is motion sickness doing exactly that? Is it trying to clear out our bodies of something?
It could be. It's very difficult to prove. Imagine the knee-jerk reflex. If you bend your knee and somebody taps your knee, your foot flicks up. I think everybody's probably experienced that. And you might think, well, why is that? In fact, evolution didn't invent that reflex so that somebody could come around with a patella hammer, make your legs flick up when they hit the knee. What it did is it has a reflex there to help your balance so that your muscles will relax and oppose each other when you're standing. And the similar theory about motion sickness, which on the face of it seems a bit crazy, doesn't it? I mean, why be sick? Why not instead be afraid or have pain or something like that? Well, the reason probably is that it's part of a poison detector system or toxin detector system. We've got many ways of detecting if we've been poisoned. Your gut can detect it. You've got a sense of smell. You've got brain receptors which can look for poisons. But as a backup, the coordination between your sense of balance and sense of vision, which is highly tuned and working 24 hours a day, even though you're not conscious of it, when that goes even slightly out of awry, the brain can use that as a secondary system to detect poisons. And so the idea is that if that starts to happen, the brain starts to think, something's going wrong, perhaps I've been poisoned. And that's what leads to vomiting.
Right.
And nausea before that.
Okay.
Otherwise, you might as well say, why not just be frightened or why not feel pain?
Yeah, true. So why is it then that there are other things that you would imagine you can get motion sickness from that you don't, like cycling or horse riding? You don't get motion sickness from those, do you?
No. You don't get horse sickness. You don't get cycling sickness. You can get car sickness, obviously, and seasickness. But, interestingly enough, you can get sick on camels and on elephants.
Oh.
And the whole difference is the frequency. That a boat or a car cornering or braking or an aircraft, some of the motions are actually very low frequency. Whereas, in fact, they're less than one cycle a second. In other words, a motion happening in which is taking longer than a second to actually perform. And that's the kind of rocking motion or heave motion that you get on a boat. It's the kind of motion you get when cornering in a car. But it's not the motion that you get if you're jogging or riding a bicycle. And those are much faster. Those are much faster motions. And like a horse can bruise you, violent motion. You don't get sick with it. You even get heavily bruised, but you don't get sick. But with a camel, if you look how a camel functions, they move actually in a very slow, lolloping fashion.
Mm.
And in fact, historically, Napoleon, in the First Battle of the Nile, when he tried to put his elite cavalry onto camels, discovered that some of them actually got seasick, or the equivalent
of
seasickness.
Wow, interesting. So
because
what...
they've got the low-frequency motion,
yes,
which you don't get on a horse.
I'm picturing a camel moving now, and just picturing it is making me feel a bit queasy, to be honest, so I get what you're saying. What about astronauts, then? Presumably they get motion sickness.
Yes, 60 to 70% of astronauts, even though they're highly fit and highly trained, will get some degree of space motion sickness. And that's probably caused by the fact you're going into zero gravity, or weightlessness, more correctly to say. And what's happening there is that your sense of where gravity is pointing has disappeared, because there is no gravity. In other words, there is no direction down. And the little organs in your inner ears, your vestibular apparatus, which gives you balance, half of those, the ones that detect gravity and linear accelerations, simply unload. They're not detecting much.
Right.
But on the other hand, your eyes are still working perfectly well, and the other systems in your inner ears, which detect circular motion, they're still working perfectly. So you've then got a continuous conflict.
Okay. Well, I don't personally get car sickness, but I do know if I'm sitting in the back and I put my head down, if I'm reading or something, then I start to feel a bit queasy. Is that the same sort of thing as car sickness?
Yes, that is. With car sickness and many types of vehicles, there are two key things to try and help reduce being sick. The best is, and you obviously can't always do this, is to be the driver, not the passenger.
Mm.
If you take rally cars, the driver never gets sick, whereas the co-driver and navigator is nearly always sick. If you swap them around, that reverses. The navigator is now the driver and doesn't get it sick, but the ex-driver is now the navigator, is getting very sick. And it's particularly nasty for them, because not only is rally driving very vigorous, and high impact, but the navigator's usually got his head down looking at a map or a computer screen, and so that person then gets conflicting information. So the two key things are, be in control if you can, so you can anticipate motion, but if you're a passenger, try to avoid scanning a map, looking at your computer, looking at your phone. Try and get a stable horizon view outside. And the same is true on board ship.
Mm.
Being below deck is far worse than being on deck and getting a stable horizon view.
Yeah, yeah. And is it true that women struggle more than men with this?
There's a huge overlap between the sexes or genders. Overall, there's a tendency for females to get more sick or be more at risk of sickness, motion sickness, than males. So on sea voyages, where you just can't escape anything, for every 5 females that get sick, 3 males will.
Wow.
But obviously there's a huge overlap.
Okay. And I also read that children younger than 6 don't generally get seasick or car sick.
Probably about the age 5 to 6, you start to begin to be susceptible to car sickness, motion sickness. Very young children, below the age of 2 or 3, they can vomit very easily, but they hardly ever get motion sick. And motion sickness susceptibility probably peaks about 8 or 9 years of age, reaches a peak there, and then gradually decreases.
Why would that be? Because their brain isn't mature enough yet?
It probably comes back to this concept of sensory conflict or sensory mismatch, which we spoke about right at the beginning. Since the theory of motion sickness is that it's a conflict between different parts of your sensory systems, your eyes, your ears, even your physical senses of touch and stuff like that, then a very young child hasn't really worked out what all the interrelationships should be. That if I move my head to the left, the visual world swings to the right. My semicircular canals, which detect angular emotion, will say that I've circled my head, etc., etc. But by the age of 5 or 6, that's beginning to be very well worked out. That for every pattern of motion possible, it's been more or less mapped out by the brain. And then only at that point, when, if you like, what's called the internal model of what should be happening is getting fairly fixed, can you become motion sick? Because there is no sensory conflict unless you have an expectancy as to how these relationships should happen between your vision, your eyes, your inner ears, your somatosensory, in other words, your body sense.
Interesting stuff. So for any of our listeners that can relate to this, is there any cure or management? What's the best thing to do?
Well, people vary tremendously in their susceptibility. About 60 to 70% of it is genetic, in other words, heritable. But there are 2 or 3 things that can make you avoid motion sickness. The most obvious one is vote with your feet. Don't go on a boat unless you can avoid it if you know you're going to be susceptible. And nowadays, say in the old days, if you want to go across the English Channel, you had very few options apart from taking a boat. Nowadays, you can take the Channel Tunnel or you can take an aircraft. Most big modern aircraft don't move around that much in terms of making you sick. Small aircraft will. The big passenger aircraft won't.
Mm-hmm.
The other key things that you can do are, as I was saying, if you're a passenger, try and get a horizon view, avoid reading or looking at your phone. If it's just a short-term exposure, you could consider taking an anti-motion sickness tablet. But they do have side effects. They make you drowsy.
Mm.
So if you're going on a sea voyage and you're going to be the driver afterwards, be careful.
Yeah, indeed.
Because you've taken an anti-motion sickness pill to get yourself across, then you're getting in your car, you're going on a long, long drive, and you're going to be drowsy. You're at risk.
Yes, of course.
So it's okay for the passengers, but not for a driver.
Yeah. Some really good advice there on motion sickness.
And you can gradually train yourself to get used to motion.
Can you?
It's called habituation. Yes, if you repeatedly expose yourself to emotion, most people will gradually get used to it. The trouble is it's a very uncomfortable process.
Yeah.
And if you're only going for an occasional sea voyage, you just don't get enough exposures.
And just one final question. I've heard of land sickness. What's land sickness then?
I'm not sure what you mean. You could mean being in a vehicle. Is that what you mean by land sickness?
It's known as mal de débarquement.
Oh, mal de débarquement.
Yeah.
Oh, I understand what you mean. What that is if you like, motion sickness caused by the reverse or the mirror image. Imagine that you've been, on a ship for many, many days and you've got used to the motion, you've habituated, you've adapted. Then your internal model of how all your sensory input should be put together has changed a bit. So you might have been seasick to begin with, you've got used to it, you've overcome it. But then, when you come back to land, your new model, which you've incorporated, starts to detect, oh, I've now got a sensory conflict by returning to land and walking around normally.
Ah.
But for most people, that's a very short-term effect, which only lasts for an hour or two.
Yeah, getting your land legs back, I guess.
Yeah. And it happens with astronauts. They get used to their space sickness after 48 hours, 2 or 3 days.
Blimey.
They're up in space for days or weeks, or for some of them months, then they come back to Earth, and one of the things which isn't popularly shown is just how groggy they are, and this lasts for quite a few days. They really have to get, apart from all sorts of other things to do with muscle wastage and bone loss, their sense of balance is really out of kilter, because they've got used to zero gravity.
Now
suddenly you've got gravity, and all the relationships are different. They're falling over, they're feeling sick. So most astronauts, you only see them a few hours later, They usually stretch it out of the vehicles.
Oh, it's a hard job.
You don't normally see that because it doesn't look so heroic, does it?
No, it doesn't. We see them a few days afterwards. Well, yeah. It's fascinating stuff. Professor John Golding, thank you so much for being on the show with us today.
Nice to chat with you.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.